Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From our studios at KUOM on the West Bank of the University of Minnesota campus, this is Culture Q, the art show that rocks. This week on Culture Q, we're cracking the code. Good evening, and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Mark Sheely. When you think of codes, the first thing you might think of is espionage, with cryptographers working to decipher some baddie's moves. For every code, there's a key. The thing is, codes also surround us in everyday life, from ordinary signs and traffic signals to the language that we speak and the music that we listen to. The stories in this week's show are all looking for a key, whether it be a series of hand signals, the German language, or the far-out musings of a notorious indie rock frontman. It's all here this week on Culture Q, and it begins right now. Board games are an important part of how we learn to follow patterns, codes, and rules as children. But what if the game is in a different language? Producers Mitch Skinner and Noel Clark attempt to use their combined 51 years of game experience to help a stuffed rabbit deliver letters by making their own rules.
If you've ever purchased a board game from a garage sale or a thrift store, chances are one or more pieces were missing.
And I got a one. I'm going to move it forward to the red splotch.
Fellow producer Mitch Skinner and I picked up a board game from a local thrift store, and the piece missing was language.
I'm assuming it's Noel's turn.
All right. The game, let's take Felix it. Ab die Post, a German game intended for children 5 and up. In the interest of full disclosure, the game does come with a rule book, translated into English and French.
It just seems like who's the best at rolling so far in this game.
But Mitch and I were curious. Will we be able to figure out the rules of the game without actually knowing them? But gather our collected knowledge of games played in the past and establish a set of rules.
Though there's no German on the board, we have no idea how to play this game because we don't know the rules. So we're just using what we know based on our culture and upbringings,
right?
Different as it may be, to try to decipher how this game is played.
So the clockwise from my space, we've got green, blue, red, and yellow, all of which have four letters apiece that need to travel all the way around the board to get back to the little strip of their matching color that delivers them to a picture of a small girl with Felix in her arms reading said letter.
So far, this just seems like an exercise in rolling, though. There are no chance cards. There's no, like, molasses.
The main game pieces are four small wooden envelopes, Felix, a six-sided wooden die with numbers 1 through 5, and a small picture of a rabbit named Felix.
Where's the base?
True. I got a Felix.
I would say that gives you a roll again as well.
I wonder what would happen if you landed on a space that was already occupied.
Yeah, do they
some rules were just made up on the spot.
I don't know.
For example, if you land on the same space as another player, you're allowed to stack on top of them. We decide for cooperation. 15 minutes into the game, I'm not doing too well.
2.
Ooh. Oh, looks like he has to go back 8 spaces or
yes,
7.
I have hit the return space. Back to ink splotch.
All right, so since there really are no rules, I am going to take out my next red piece.
The board is fairly straightforward, with spaces that correspond with the size and shape of the pieces.
I see. Curious.
I really don't know if that's legal or not.
Well, that's the point of the game.
However, a few spots perplex us, namely one larger square that features a picture of Felix and Sophie, his owner, engaged in a massive cuddle. Mitch dubs these Felix Love Zones. We decide that the Felix Love Zone does the same thing that rolling a Felix on the die does, the opportunity to roll again.
The shortest way I can describe it, it's sorry with a lot less going on. Like, there are really no like jump forward or jump back spaces, and it doesn't seem like I can kick Noel back to the beginning.
Right. It's sorry, but there's nothing really to be sorry for yet.
Right.
With very few penalty squares, the game moves pretty quickly, yet it still takes us over 25 minutes.
Based on the colors, I'm assuming I want to end up in the red base.
Right, right. The envelope folds on the back of the game pieces match the envelope folds on the board. And the same with the other side. The postage matches the postage at the finish line. So it seems like it makes sense. It'll be interesting to see what it actually means.
The game is brief, right, so and a bit confusing, and frankly a little dull. We can't help but feel like we're missing something.
Keep rolling ones. Nobody's going anywhere very fast.
Eventually, Mitch puts me out of my misery.
Stay tuned. Three.
Oh!
And that is the game. For Culture Cube, I'm Mitch Skinner.
For Culture Cube, stay tuned.
For people who normally don't watch baseball, the jargon can seem like the vocabulary from a foreign language. But those who actually play the game are using parts of another language, and their words aren't spoken, they're signed. Producer Markita Fornov has the story.
Signs have officially been a part of baseball since 1905, which is when umpire Bill Kelm is credited with creating the signs for ball, strike, and safe. However, newspapers up and down the East Coast noted that these signs were used as early as 1888 by a deaf center fielder with the given name William Hoy. However, he is better known by his preferred name, Dummy.
When he went in to play pro baseball, they did not use the signs for strike, out, ball, those sorts of things, foul. They basically shouted. So he taught one of the umpires a few signs before the start of each game. And that's also how umpires today use the signs for strike, ball, out, those sorts of things.
The words you just heard are from Alex Zebot, an American Sign Language instructor at the University of Minnesota. But the voice you heard belongs to Jules, an interpreter from the U of M's Disability Services. Zebot was born in Latvia in 1967 with the ability to hear, but at the age of 3 months old, he contracted spinal meningitis and had 95 decibel hearing loss in both of his ears.
I could have died from spinal meningitis. I could have been brain damaged. I could have been a quadriplegic. So actually being only deaf, so to speak, really was kind of a saving grace.
Zebot didn't let his inability to hear prevent him from playing sports with hearing and non-hearing teammates alike. Communicating with other players was easier when teams had designated signs, even if the signs weren't necessarily true to American Sign Language.
Typically what they're using is kind of symbolic or symbols. It's things that they've made up themselves. It's not really a sign. It's not vocabulary that's taken from or copied from American Sign Language.
As Zebot said, most signs are made up or agreed upon by teams individually, but there are some signals that remain standard throughout nearly every league.
When the pitchers and catchers are talking about what pitch to throw, they almost always use the same signs, which is when one is, you know, so the catcher will get down in his squat and his hand is between his leg. And he'll put down one finger for fastball, two finger for curveball, three for slider. The pitcher and the catcher will make sure they agree on the signs before the game, but it's almost always one is fastball, two is curveball.
Rob Warren, a veteran Pee Wee baseball coach of 20 years, and the voice you just heard, has a system for coding other signals that are given out in the open.
And our bunt sign is usually something about the belt buckle, because there's alliteration, right? So belt buckle, bunt.
Simplicity and subtlety are key. But sometimes even these tried-and-true signals lead to slip-ups.
A very common one for kids this age is like, if I touch skin anywhere, arms, legs, you know, my face, whatever, that means steal. But like if a mosquito lands on me, especially if I didn't notice that I just slapped a mosquito, the kid will get thrown out trying to steal because it was a terrible time to steal and the catcher was really good and that kid was slow and I never would have had him steal. He'll come off the field and I'll say, like, you know, Johnny or Susie or whoever, how come you stole there? Like, I didn't give you this sign and it was, you know, we had two outs and we really needed you to not get out. And he'll say, well, coach, you did this. You're right, I did. Sorry. It's on me.
Misinterpretation isn't the only thing that coaches and players worry about. They also try to avoid the interception of their signs as well.
The coach is right out in the open doing all of those signals, but they're secret. I mean, they're, you know, they're in code. And they're actually sometimes very complicated. It would be hard to figure out what they are.
However, interception isn't likely to occur because behind each team's secret code is an unspoken honor code.
So there's a few norms in baseball about signs, and one is that the batter can't look at the catcher. The other is, if you find out that the other team is stealing your signs, that's equally bad, and you can sort of expect some retaliation. It's just not cool to steal the other team's signs. And everyone kind of respects that, and if there's any transgressions, there's always some violent masculine retribution for doing that.
For Culture Q, I'm Markita Fornoff.
Playing any game without the rules is an adventure. With the game Felix Abdi Post, Noel Clark and I actually had the rules and chose not to use them to experience the process of decoding a game completely foreign to its players. That went, well, you heard how that went.
Felix has brought a couple of ideas from his many travels to play the popular game of elimination, but a differently typical of Felix. Oh, it's even translated terribly.
Yeah. Surprisingly, though, we weren't that far off in our original playthrough. Even still, the game played a lot different when we had all the rules. While some of the rules are fairly evident, we learned that even small changes to the game could reshape the entirety of how it's played. For example, when we made the rules, we let any piece land anywhere. But it turns out two letters can't occupy the same space. If you land on an occupied space, it turns out you get to kick the other player's piece to the start of the game. This changed a lot.
So if you land on one of these fields while it's occupied by another letter, the other letter can be kicked out. You cannot kick out your own letters. If you don't have any other possibility to move, you must stay where you are. So what I gather from that is that you can kick somebody out and then they go back to their
envelope field.
Envelope field.
Or maybe the mustard stain spot. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
Did Bing.com translate this?
But after reading the rules, we got it mostly figured out. I was able to jump out to an early lead because Noel couldn't advance any of his pieces out of the starting zone. This made the game a little more dramatic because it wasn't just about taking turns trying to roll high numbers. We had to roll specific numbers to advance.
I could see how this game would be really one-sided then if you can go the entire game without actually being able to play it.
Yeah.
That seems a little cruel.
That seems a little bit, I don't know, I like that idea a little bit more. But then again, I'm winning again.
That's eventually true. Noel was able to get out. It turned out being able to kick each other back to start and forcing each other to roll sixes to advance made the game a lot more competitive and frankly fun.
This is miserable.
Still, it didn't matter because I came out on top again. Take that, Noel. But we were both able to learn a valuable lesson about decoding games from this experience. Reading the rules isn't enough because sometimes they're incoherent or just make no sense without context. For example, the rules to Felix Abdi Post mentioned something called cuddle zones. This term made no sense to us without being able to see the board itself.
So you notice even in a language we understand, like English, if it is not properly coded, like grammar, that way that we're used to, it can be confusing and we just won't understand the game properly.
Right, and I'll go about 17 turns before actually getting to start the game.
Right, so you might know what each individual word means, but if it's not constructed in the proper way, you know, a coherent sentence.
Right.
The code just doesn't work.
There are codes within codes. Knowing a language doesn't necessarily make you able to understand it. For Culture Q, I'm Mitch Skinner.
The journey that our recyclables take is more intricate than most of us will ever get to see. So reporter Amy Friedman is taking us into the university recycling facility to get the noisy, smelly, and always surprising details that make up the fascinating cycle of recycling.
Recyclables always seem like the cleaner, neater sibling of the trash family. At the University of Minnesota Recycling Center, we find that the reality is not so neat. Instead, it is a kind of trash wonderland, always balancing on the line between order and chaos. You can find the order in the front of the building, where sorting of the recyclables takes place. Student recycling coordinator Josh Kiley explains the personal treatment that every bottle and every last newspaper gets when it passes through their facility.
The material that we accept in a cans and bottles bin would be aluminum, tin, plastic, and glass. So all of that material comes in one bag, so we have to sort it out into the specific types of material, otherwise we're not going to get any money for it. So we hand sort the plastic out, the aluminum, the tin, and the glass all gets touched.
Recycling is never as simple as the bins labeled paper, plastic, and glass make it appear. This is why the personal touch to recycling is so important. It is not just a job of sorting, but also of problem solving and critical thinking. And as recycling coordinator Aaron Bristow explains, sometimes the job can be downright puzzling.
We got something that we have no absolute idea. It's a cryomagnetic something. It's been in the warehouse for almost a year now, and so we're just trying to find out what do you do with this, you know, it's right. Like 4 feet tall, 2 feet wide, a chrome bullet-shaped monster of a...
It could have gone in the trash a long time ago, but we're keeping it just because there might be a way to get rid of it in the more proper way.
That pesky cryomagnetic something is not the only thing to give the team problems. Even something as simple as plastic can be extremely difficult to sort. This is where critical thinking can turn to quirky tricks.
When it's not labeled, the best way to find out what kind of plastic it is to burn it and smell it.
Some plastic burns clear, some plastic burns, it will get black when you burn it. So there are differences, but I don't think it's very healthy to be smelling plastic. But sometimes you have to do it.
After all the recyclables are given their moment of human contact, touched, tossed, crushed, picked apart, or, of course, burned, they are ushered to the back of the building, where they wait.
You have to accrue a lot of material in order to sell it, so you need space.
What Aaron is talking about by space is the part of the facility that can get a bit chaotic. This is a huge warehouse, straight out of a nightmarish episode of Hoarders.
This is a whole bunch of different. We've got wire, metal, all of these different kind of electronics. Monitors, keyboards, holy cow, there's a whole bunch of stuff.
These mountains of recyclables are waiting, so that when there is enough material, they can be sold. A lot of the agonizing details of sorting come down to profitability. Trash is expensive, and the university saves money with everything they don't just throw away.
All the trash here in Hanson Hall, in the restrooms, we have now gone green, which means we're composting every bit of it that we possibly can. So, I mean, when I go pick up the trash from the restrooms in the afternoon, I'm hoping 99.9% of the trash that I'm picking on up has already been sorted on out so they don't have to sort it over in recycling.
That was custodian Matt Welter. For years, he has pushed a focus on compost to help minimize the university's waste. At first glance, all of these people seem a bit obsessed with trash. However, Their obsession is merely the understanding that garbage has so much more potential when we pay attention to it than it does ignored and mixed into obscurity in a landfill.
This story comes from reporter Amy Friedman. Stick around, there's still more Culture Q to come.
Welcome back, Culture Q listeners. My name is Mitch Skinner, and I am joined in studio with Noel Clark to count down the top seven things we learned about decoding a board game you've never played before.
That's right. We decided to try to play a game that was not only something that we never played before, but it was not even in a language that we were both fluent in. And in doing that, we had to rely on what is number seven on our list, using past experience to get us through navigating the board.
You probably heard in our story a little bit, there's parts where we say, oh, it's like Sorry, or hey, it's like Monopoly. We got this piece here, and it goes in the directions the arrows are pointing. That's like this board game I've already played.
Right. Rolling a number on a die usually means that you move the number of spaces on the die.
Yeah, it's a fairly universal language, thankfully, because, as he said, we do not speak German. Number six thing we learned about decoding a board game is look at the markings on the board. This means if there's any patterns, shapes, arrows are a huge indicator. Again, it's a universal language. You just follow the arrow in the direction it points. Really helped us figure out what we were doing and which way to go.
And pieces. Pieces on the game pieces tend to match spaces on the board, or at least imply what direction you're supposed to go in. Now, that's not necessarily always true. I'm going to pick on Monopoly again with, like, say, a top hat or a giant shoe, but houses on property, it seems to make sense.
And the marking that might not even be on the board, but it might be sort of intuitive. For example, most board games go clockwise. So if there aren't any arrows, chances are you're going clockwise. So number five, Noel.
Number five, if you don't know what the rules are, or if you can't find them, or if they've just otherwise been ruined, just make them up.
Yeah, sometimes it's more fun than the game itself. I don't know if that speaks more to just how fun it is to make something up or just some games being awful, but sometimes it's just a blast to make rules up. I'm not sure if it was any more fun playing without the rules for this game, though.
Well, it's certainly no Calvin Ball, though it could be a game that, much like Calvin Ball from Calvin and Hobbes, is different every time you play it because the rules are different every time.
Well, on to number four. Consider the context of the game you're playing. For example, this is, on the board, apparently, a rabbit who delivers envelopes. So chances are it has something to do with mail, and you're trying to deliver those letters. That's the context.
Life has the stages of life and people in a car driving around on oddly paved streets. But that's, you know, that's life. And that's life is a game.
Okay. Number three thing that we learned when decoding this board game.
There is typically a starting point and a goal. So in life, it's obviously you go from rags to riches, or from being a single dude alone in your college dorm room to having a family and a mortgage. Mm-hmm. Or in this game, for example, you start out with all of your envelopes at home in one of the four places that you start, and you have to deliver them to Sophie, the little girl who is Felix's pen pal.
Right. Again, this isn't Calvin Ball. Most board games have those empirical rules that you just have to follow. And so it's going to have a starting point, certain paths, and then a definitive end.
Right. Nobody would play a game if there was no way to win or end it.
Incidentally, half of the games that I play end with me flipping the board in frustration. Number two, always roll again. This is featured in just about any game with a die or dice.
Yes, absolutely. And it makes games go a lot quicker. We found that rolling again helped us move around the board much, much faster, to the point where we even doubled up the number of roll agains and allowed infinite roll agains, and the rules didn't even allow for it.
And the number one, if you can help it, rule for decoding a game, read the rules. It's fairly straightforward, fairly intuitive, but it really does help.
Exactly. If you don't know how to score it, you're not going to know who won, or there will be debates over
what words are admissible in games such as Scrabble or Upwords.
There'll be board flipping.
Or Boggle. There'll be world domination and Risk and board flipping.
Or Scrabble, world domination and Scrabble.
This is also true. And the beauty of the internet is that now that you can typically find some sort of document to explain to you how to play these games.
Right, or at least Google Translate or some sort of translation device if it's not in a language you know. All right, that concludes our top seven. I'm Mitch Skinner.
And I'm Noel Clark.
Keep on listening to Culture Cue.
The Flaming Lips. If you listen to Radio K, then you've probably heard of them. If not their lengthy discography, you've heard about their carnivalesque live performance. But they weren't always ringmasters of confetti and balloons. Producer Tess Weinberg charts the path that the band has taken to get where they are today.
All right, hello everybody. My name is Wayne. I'm the singer in a group called Flaming Lips, and it's the greatest job anybody could ever have.
Just releasing their most recent album, which is called The Flaming Lips and Heady Fwens, The Flaming Lips collaborated with artists like Yoko Ono, Erykah Badu, Nick Cave, and Kesha. Although their sound has transformed over their nearly three-decade career, the band has always been interested in experimentation.
I think in the beginning we didn't really know what we were doing, I think, which really helped us not sound like a normal band. When we started, we weren't even thinking that it would last a year or would be worth lasting for a year. And now it seems like it'll probably go on probably till I die, maybe even beyond that, you know, which could be a year from now or 20 years. I don't really know, you know.
Well, the Flaming Lips of 30 years ago when they first started were a very different band.
This is Stuart Berman.
Hi, this is Stuart Berman. I am a reviewer for Pitchfork, and I've been contributing to the site for about 6 years now. They were a much more messy garage rock band, part of that early 80s indie rock movement. But, you know, as they moved on, they got a little more melodic, a little more psychedelic. Over time, they sort of got a little tired of the sort of regular rock band routine and decided to shake things up.
After their first few albums, they really started experimenting with production with albums like Zurika.
This bizarre 4-CD set, which came out in 1997, and that was designed to be played on 4 stereos simultaneously.
Which led to their album, The Soft Bulletin.
Their next record, The Soft Bulletin, sort of combined that experimental ethos with the more of a pop structure, and it became their first true sort of commercial breakthrough.
Which arguably made the band what it is today.
And I think, you know, the combination of the Soft Bulletin success and their popularity as this crazy live band really sort of elevated the band to, you know, a new level. But they've been going, you know, a lot weirder and a lot more avant-garde in their sort of presentation. She said I can be a frog. Which is really interesting because the band continues to be very popular as a touring band, but their music is getting even stranger than it ever has before. I can be a cat. You know, the Flaming Lips work very well as children's music, I think, as well as weird, druggy music.
It's true. Their live performances are somewhere between a fantastical children's carnival and a freaky lucid dream.
You know, if you've never seen that before, it's going to be the greatest show you've ever seen.
The visual aspect of their performances go hand in hand with the music.
I mean, I think for me, it really is not just sound, you know, it is about everything all at the same time. If you invite us in with everything you got, your eyes, your ears, your intellect, your feelings, everything, we can get in there and it'll be great.
Coyne compares their live show to a movie, something that sucks you in completely and immerses you.
Hey, I mean, and we want people to cry. I mean, crying is great. It's proof that you're being affected, you know.
They want it to be a communal experience.
And we're part of that community. It isn't just that we play and say they had fun, see you later. I mean, we want to be caught up in not just the music we do, but the reaction that they're giving us. It's not like we go out there every night and go, do you realize? It's not every night. So, you know, when the audience is really responding and they're crying and they're just surrendering to this joy or this power or whatever it is, we're kind of doing that too, you know?
As the Flaming Lips go on, they seem to be finding new ways to create and share their music.
I think the Flaming Lips still seem as though music that's made just slightly in the future, and we're here now, you know what I mean? I don't know why, it just feels like that's kind of our trip, you know? If all this ended tomorrow, I'd say, damn, it was cool. But I don't want it to end, you know? What do you do then, you know?
For Culture Q, I'm Tess Weinberg.
Well, that's all for our show this week. Contributors to this week's show were Mitch Skinner, Noel Clark, Amy Friedman, Markita Fornoff, and Tess Weinberg. Producers for Culture Q are Tess Weinberg, Mitch Skinner, Noel Clark, and Markita Fornoff. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and host and managing editor is me, Mark Sheely. You can find Culture Q on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And if you miss something fascinating, you can always find recent episodes of Culture Q online at radiok.org. Thanks for listening, and as always, we'll see you next week. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.